KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Present, we can't look at any one event and I link it to global climate change.
If you take all of the fish out of the reef and weigh them, the top predators, like the sharks, account for most of the biomass. That would be the equivalent of having as many lions as wildebeest in Africa.
You know, I wait for those moments. You know, I love having the ball in my hands with 2 minutes to go. Or when we're down, we got to get a touchdown. We need something. You know, that's where I thrive. That's where I want to have the ball in my hands to win a game.
Russell Wilson talking about the Falcons game. We're going to head over to the chat room and talk about what happened over the weekend with sports and also, you know, what it means for our fair city. That is something we'll talk about with Prometheus Brown, a.k.a. Geologic, the MC Geologic, a blues scholar, and Leah Baltus, editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. That's at about 10:40. We're also going to talk with Philip Moat about climate change and a new report. But we're going to start with a conversation I had just yesterday with Enrique Sala, National Geographic Explorer in Residence. This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. Working at the intersection of science and policy, Enrique Sala is looking for the last pristine marine environments on Earth and wants to bring back enough data to urge governments into protecting them. Enrique Sala is a National Geographic Explorer in Residence. He was an academic teaching at the Scripps Howard Institute before he made his way to the National Geographic's Pristine Seas Expeditions. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
What is what we have now? Describe what we have now in some of the coral reefs, the baseline that you say most of us sort of assume to be the ocean's standard.
The baseline is not pretty good. To a quarter of the coral reefs of the world are gone, where there used to be healthy coral gardens with sharks and lots of big fish. Now we have dead corals overgrown by slime and seaweed, and most of the fishes are smaller than the mask that we use for diving.
What's the consequences of having degraded reefs like this?
The consequences are that fisheries go down, all the livelihoods they support go down. And not only that, you know, impacting the ocean, not just coral reefs, diminishes the ability of the ocean to give us many things that we absolutely need, like oxygen. You know, the oxygen that we breathe, more than half of it comes from little creatures living in the ocean. The ocean regulates the climate. It gives us more than 100 million tons of seafood every year and provides many billions of dollars and hundreds of millions of jobs.
Are you pessimistic about the trajectory the oceans are taking?
It's very difficult to be optimistic, Steve. There are things that we can solve. There are things that it's probably too late. For example, some sharks have been overfished so much that in the last 100 years we have killed more than 99% of them. But then there are other areas where we can still make a positive impact.
I thought that reefs were just generally disappearing around the world. But you've gone to some places where reefs are still resilient enough to rebound from impacts of climate change and overfishing.
Yes, even though our footprint in the ocean is global, there are still a few remote places, uninhabited, untouched, that look like the ocean 500, 1,000 years ago. And these pristine reefs are completely opposite to everything we thought about the ocean. They are full of large predators, so many sharks. And as you said, these systems, these reefs are like a machine that is complete. All the parts are there. And the machine works so well that if you hit it, you know, it can recover. So these reefs, when there is an El Nino year, for example, a year where the water is too warm for too long, the corals die, but they come back.
You know, you talk about a time machine, and these are time machines. They also are sort of literally inverting our understanding of the pyramid, the ecosystem pyramid. Explain how that is.
Yeah, this is something that we had no idea about, and we discovered when we started exploring these pristine reefs. And, you know, if you think of a wild ecosystem, you think about the African plains, for example. You think of hundreds of thousands of wildebeest and thousands of gazelle, antelope, zebras, and a few hundred lions. That's what we learn in school from textbooks, that we have a huge biomass of the herbivores, the lower parts of the food chain, and then a very small biomass of top predators. And that's what we thought happened on coral reefs. But when we went to these pristine places, we found that we discovered that this biomass pyramid is inverted. So if you take all of the fish out of the reef and weigh them, the top predators, like the sharks, account for most of the biomass. That would be the equivalent of having as many lions as wildebeest in Africa.
Now, so does that tell us something about how all ecosystems actually would operate, or just what's happening in the ocean?
That's what's happening in the ocean. On land, something like this would not be possible. But on coral reefs, every pristine reef we've been to shows the same pattern. The biomass of the predators outweighs the biomass of the prey.
So how could that be? What's happening there?
Yeah, that took us a while to figure out. It was so surprising, and we revised our calculations, and we went to another place and another and another. And after a few examples, we saw that that was the general pattern. This is what pristine coral reefs were supposed to be like. And the way it works is very simple. It has to do with the rate of turnover of the different levels of the food chain. And to make a long story short, on the top of the food chain, you have sharks that can live to 25, 30 years. They reproduce very slowly, and they produce up to 5 pups per year, and they start reproducing after age 7. On the bottom of the food chain, you have these smaller fish that grow to 3, 5, 7 years. They reproduce like crazy, producing millions of eggs every year. So they produce so much offspring that, let's say, that this production surplus of the lower levels of the food chain is enough to keep the sharks up there. You know, just everything they eat, they use to maintain their biomass.
Dr. Henry Sala is a marine ecologist. He worked as a professor at the Scripps Institute for Oceanography. He was a 2005 Aldo Leopold Leadership Fellow, a 2006 Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation. He's a 2008 Young Global Leader at the World Communication Humanities National Economic Forum in Davos, and then was a 2006 Prince Asturias Award for Communication and Humanities with National Geographic. I list those because you are a scientist and a communicator. You have this goal of getting this information out to the rest of us. I'm just being cynical again, but why do you think that getting that information out is going to prod entrenched interests in fishing in particular, but also shipping, sonar exploration and experimentation that militaries do to shift their patterns of exploitation of the oceans, not to mention pollution and plastics, etc.?
You know, of course, you know, Steve, for a long time there was this artificial polarization between conservation and economic development. And we were told, well, we don't have the luxury to preserve nature because we need to grow our economy. And, you know, it's been a long time since we know that we cannot grow a sustainable economy without a healthy environment. You know, there are no financial markets on the moon because there is no life biological system to support that market. And here on our planet, everything is supported by the biosphere, the biological basis of our society and economy. And the only way for changing these patterns of behavior and exploitation is for the decision makers to understand that it's in their interest and in the interest of businesses to have this healthy environment. And I can give you an example. 99% of the ocean is open to fishing. Only 1% is protected, right? And we have learned that in this 1%, there are about 6,000 marine protected areas of different sizes. And these marine reserves, they bring back the fish spectacularly. Fish abundance increases 5 times on average relative to unprotected sites. And after a few years, there are so many fish inside these reserves that they reproduce so much that they spill over. So these reserves are like fish banks. They are acting like a savings account with a principal that we set aside. They replenish the neighboring areas, and the fishermen are catching more and making more money. And then in some places, the tourism industry is bringing a lot of jobs and a lot of cash too. And the Great Barrier Reef in Australia is the best example. 56,000 jobs and $4.5 billion in revenue, thanks to a protected area. So it's in the interest of businesses to have a healthy environment.
You know, right now, this last week on the Columbia River, there's a decision to restrict gillnetters who have for a long time been catching and using the Columbia, gillnetting the Columbia, two side reefs, arguing that they'll be able to catch enough hatchery fish in those side reefs, in those side channels, to sustain themselves. The gillnetters saying, no, you're giving too much to sports fishermen, the tribes are taking too much, we're going to lose our livelihood. That's the kind of arguments that we seem to hear. Why doesn't the argument about marine reserves, which you're telling me you have the data to back it up, why don't those arguments take hold amongst those constituents who are dependent upon those services?
Yeah, this is a very common problem. We see the same debate everywhere. And there are three main reasons why marine reserves haven't been expanded the way that we would like. One is that there is a huge lack of awareness. Most people don't know what marine reserves mean, and most people don't know what the benefits of reserves are. The second problem is that the governance is not right. Usually it's local communities have a hard time creating their own fish banks and managing them, because usually they have to be created by government agencies. So empowering local communities would help a lot. And the third one is that the funding models have been wrong. Basically, everybody sees marine reserves as a sink of resources that have to be subsidized by governments, you know, or philanthropic institutions.
I mean, like the park, you have to establish it, you have to hire people, and that all costs money.
Exactly. But we have shown that these reserves can pay for themselves, and they can turn a profit and create jobs. So what we are arguing is that local communities should get together, people who want to protect and people who want to exploit, and figure out a way to invest in the creation of these marine protected areas so that all of the community becomes a shareholder of the benefits.
Where are the most successful marine reserves today? What are the models you would build on?
Great models. I'm going to give you two examples. One very large, I already talked about, the Great Barrier Reef, which is bringing billions of dollars to the Australian economy. And then you have two examples, one in Mexico and one in Kenya. In Mexico, a local community decided to create a national park because they understood that they were overfishing. 10 years, we went there right after the creation of the park and measured how many fish were there. We came back 10 years later, and the recovery of the fish has been the largest in the world.
Where's that?
This is in Cabo Pulmo in Baja California. And this is a small reserve managed by the locals with no government agencies involved. And now the former fishermen are all tourist guides, and they are making much more money than when they were fishing. And another example is in Kenya, this small reserve of Mombasa on the Indian Ocean. The fishermen around this reserve their income is twice as high as the income in other places where there are no reserves. And we have hundreds of examples of reserves from the small to the large all around the world.
And you can sustain that? I mean, there isn't somebody who comes in, some big, not to pick on them, but some big Taiwanese trawler doesn't come in and drag those reserves with nets and scoop up the fish?
Of course, there is always the risk, you know, of the free riders. But when you develop this fish bank, you need to make sure that the access rights around the reserve are clearly established, so the local communities can have exclusive access rights, so they can benefit, so they have a vested interest in having lots of fish inside the reserve so they can spill over. Yes, the problem of the free riders is a big one, but it can be easily solved if the governments allow for clear access rights.
Dr. Enrique Sala is a marine ecologist, National Geographic Explorer in Resident.
I thought the Great Barrier Reef was having some health problems. I thought that the corals were dying there. Is that not the case?
The Great Barrier Reef is protected from local fish, from local human impacts like fishing and pollution. But it's not safe from the global impacts like global warming. The water is getting too warm for too long some summers, and then the corals bleach massively and die. But the good news about marine reserves is that we've seen that when the corals bleach and die in an area without sharks, without large predators, they die. And they are overgrown by bacteria and algae, and they are not coming back. In a protected area where we have this fully functioning ecological machine, the reefs come back within a few years. So when we have a system that is intact, that has all the levels of the food chain, where it has the big predators, that system is resilient. It can come back from these short-term climate change impacts.
Has any of your science showed a way to reseed areas that have already degraded?
Yeah, that's a question that has been explored in different places, like replanting corals and reseeding fish. But what we have seen is that it is much more efficient and much more economic to protect places so the fish can come back than trying to farm fish and then release them in the field.
Well, you describe as a young boy watching Jacques Cousteau diving in the Mediterranean and seeing abundance of creatures. And then when you went down there, you showed a slide in your TED Talk of nothing, just an empty ocean.
Yes, I was very confused and disappointed because I expected the sea to be rich as Jacques Cousteau showed us in his films. And off the Mediterranean coast of Spain, there was nothing. And that changed the moment I did my first dive in a marine reserve. And then I discovered, and when I jumped in the water and saw these big fish and the groupers and the lobsters that Cousteau showed us that I had never seen during my childhood, that very moment, that was the epiphany. I discovered everything that we have lost. But also, that was kind of a hopeful moment for me because I thought, well, the entire ocean was supposed to be like this. If we have been able to recover this small area in Spain, in the Mediterranean, which is the most overfished sea in the planet historically, wow, we can do this everywhere else.
Wow. Have you seen it grow? Have you seen areas grow in Mediterranean?
I've seen them grow in the Mediterranean, the Medas Islands Marine Reserve, where I did that first epiphany, that amazing dive. I've seen it recover over the years and this place in Cabo Pulmo. I've seen it go from a degraded place that was really, really sad to a completely pristine area with lots of sharks, including large tiger sharks. So you can see it within a decade. You can see the change with your own eyes. You don't need the statistics or economic studies. You jump in the water and immediately you know what the change has been.
When you saw that least degraded place when you started the traveling and diving, where was it and do you remember how you felt?
Yeah. No, I was a professor at Scripps in California, and I was tired of seeing all these places that I love so much being more and more degraded, and I was tired of being a pathologist. I found myself rewriting the obituary of the ocean with increased precision, and I thought that, I want to be like a doctor trying to find a solution, but the first question is, what do we want the ocean to look like? Which takes us to the next question. What was the ocean like 500, 1,000 years ago? So I decided to organize an expedition to a virgin reef. And we found these reefs south of Hawaii, between Hawaii and French Polynesia, on the Line Islands in the middle of the Pacific, that have some of the most remote and uninhabited reefs. And we hoped these reefs would be pristine. They would be like this time machine, that window to the past. And we were right. We jumped in the water, and immediately we were surrounded by 10, 15 great reef sharks. Schools of 20 to 50 red snappers came to check us out. They even bit my ponytail and our fins and strobes to see if we tasted good. That was like getting in a time machine.
That's like Captain Cook experienced.
No, absolutely. That was pure exploration, and I felt like what Darwin must have felt when he stepped for the first time in the Galapagos.
You know, in your TED Talk that's on YouTube, you talk about that, and you also show that you're in these Lion Islands, and if there's a, what was it, 2,500 people living on the island, the reef is somewhat degraded. I think you had 5,500; it was even more degraded. I mean, it seems to take very few people on this planet to degrade the oceans, considering the billions. What sort of initial steps are going to be possible? I mean, we're going to have to leave some areas in order to actually protect them, or...
You know, you are absolutely right about, you know, how few people it takes to degrade an area. And I think that we need to do two things. One is to save these last wild places that are still remote and untouched before they go. This is like saving the Grand Canyons, Yosemites of the world, Yellowstones. You know, we need to protect these last wild places, which are not too many. But then, for the rest of the world where people live and make a livelihood out of the ocean, there is a solution. We don't need to protect everything, but we can start creating these small fish banks so the people can continue exploring the ocean in a sustainable way, because we have these savings accounts, the fish banks that are helping to replenish.
How big should they be, a good reserve?
A good reserve, it depends on the objectives of the reserve, but a reserve as small as 1 square kilometer, like the one I talked about in the Mediterranean, can produce significant tourism benefits. But, you know, the larger the reserve, the larger the benefits, and the cheaper it is to manage it. And, you know, if we think of these reserves as a savings account, of course you want your principal to be as large as possible to get much more interest.
Have you found that where those reserves are established and expanding, that... who are your biggest supporters? Are they fishermen, or are they the tourist industry that's hoping to bring people out in boats and diving, et cetera?
In the beginning, the tourism industry, educators, scientists, and conservationists are the best allies. And we tend to have fishermen against this concept. But after a few years, when the reserves are providing benefits, it's the fishermen who come and say, can we expand the reserve? And we've seen this in many places around the world.
This is the tragedy of the commons reversed. People understand the value of the commons. What leaders, what nations do you think are most attuned right now to expanding? Because it's a very simple idea, but it's also a very hard one to get people to get behind.
Yeah, we have great examples of large marine protected areas in the United States. And President Bush, before leaving office, he created some of the largest marine reserves in the world. The government of Australia also has decided to protect huge chunks of their nation. And there are nations in both developing and developed countries that have created some of these large reserves. But also we have examples like in the Philippines, where we have now hundreds of marine reserves created by local communities in their own islands, because the law allows them to create their own fish banks. So we have good examples from around the world.
And what are there, just the local villagers cruising around in little boats, reminding people that these are the parameters of this reserve, don't fish on this side of the line?
Exactly. And, you know, when you have a community of islands where everybody fishes, they know that if they have a reserve, they don't want other guys to come to fish around the reserve. And, you know, it would be a social sin to do so in a place where everybody depends on the same resource. So when you have a... When people have knowledge about the benefits, then the community can enforce itself.
Dr. Enrique Sala is a marine ecologist. He holds the position on marine conservation ecology at the Spanish National Council for Scientific Research. And in 2008, he became a National Geographic Explorer in Residence. He's talking about these issues tonight at Benaroya Hall as part of the National Geographic Live series. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
-39 degrees in Seattle with a little bit of blue sky, a little bit of sun, and quite a few clouds. Forecast says we're expecting it to be mostly cloudy for most of the day with temperatures in the upper 30s.
Radioactive is a program where youth producers tell stories and learn about behind the scenes of public radio.
I feel like I said that wrong.
Radioactive Spring Workshop starts in February and is open to youth ages 16 to 18. Apply by January 21st at kuow.org/radioactive.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, who work in cooperation with state regulators to comply with safety regulations and practices and provide product quality. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:30, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Speaking of the oceans, the decline of corals due to acidification, overfishing, and a change in the climate. A 60-member National Climate Assessment and Development Advisory Committee just released a draft of the National Climate Assessment Report. Philip Mote is the director of Oregon Climate Change Research Institute. He's a professor in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University. And he joins us from across the ocean to talk about these issues. Professor Mote, good to talk to you again.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. It's a sunny, bright day in the Northwest. Maybe more will be coming.
Bright winter days.
Yeah, yeah. What's new or scientifically significant in this new draft?
There are a number of things. This is the most comprehensive national climate assessment report ever. There have been three of them. One was issued in 2000, one in 2009, and this one is due out next February. What was released Friday is a draft for peer review and public comment, so all of the findings are considered provisional at this point.
Is there...
Some of the interesting findings are in Chapter 1, just a very much stronger set of statements about observed climate changes, and then there are 8 chapters about changes in different regions and a bunch on changes in, you know, water resources and agriculture and so on.
There's a letter that was part of this. Summers are longer and hotter. Periods of extreme heat last longer than any living American has experienced. Winters are generally shorter and warmer. Rain comes in heavier downpours, though in many regions there are longer dry spells in between. Is this assessment saying what people think is true, but we've only accepted it anecdotally, that short-term weather occurrences are in some way influenced by climate change?
Well, the report assesses observed, it assesses literature, scientific findings that have been published, and so in some cases, since the last assessment report 4 years ago, there have been substantial new findings, some observed trends that have become stronger, and so there are a number of conclusions that are stronger than we were able to make 4 years ago.
I see. I mean, people looked at Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy, and said, oh, this is happening because of climate change. But others say, well, it's still one single storm. We can't make those extrapolations. This report give – who does this report help?
The study of extreme events is particularly interesting and challenging. By definition, they're extreme, they're rare, and so doing good statistics on them becomes difficult. And assessing what role humans may have played in changing those statistics is also difficult. But, you know, there are certainly some things that are very clearly linked to rising greenhouse gases and some trends that are extremely strong. So over the last 20 years, the U.S. has set high temperature records at more than twice the rate that it set low temperature records, and that's consistent with a warming climate. One scientist I know has helped us understand this question of what role humans may have played in a given extreme event by an analogy with baseball. So Superstorm Sandy or any other single event can't by itself be attributed. A baseball player who starts taking steroids and doubles his rate of hitting home runs, you can't say that any one home run was caused by the steroids. But you can say that he's much likelier to hit a home run when he's on steroids.
Or in Lance Armstrong cases, winning a Tour de France. So we have this new draft of the National Climate Assessment Report from the 60-member committee. Are these all climate scientists that are on this committee?
Well, it's a very interesting committee. There are actually two groups of people involved with this. One is the advisory committee, which oversees the whole process, and the second is the group of authors. So there are about 300 authors. There are a total of 60 what are called coordinating lead authors, two for each of the 30 chapters, and many of those COAs are also drawn from the NACADAC. But the folks on this advisory committee, or NACADAC as we call it, have come from all walks of life. A very small number are climate scientists. They're experts more in the real world. So, for example, Paul Fleming from Seattle Public Utilities is heavily involved in the water chapter and is also on the advisory committee. So we have attorneys and investors and people from insurance industry, and this gives it a much broader base of ownership and ensures that it's more relevant to the problems that people in America who are affected by variability and change in climate, that we're actually dealing with the issues that concern them.
Philip Mote, may I say that NACADAC is an excellent acronym, and that you folks should use that all the time to get people to pay attention to climate change science.
Oh, we do. It's delightful to say it in the meetings. It brings a chuckle every time.
That's wonderful. All right, how does this report get implemented? How will this report be used?
Well, we hope that a number of the folks who have been engaged in developing it, both as authors and as members of the committee, and also the more extended group of people in the networks created for this assessment, that they will look at the information in the chapters and some of the calculations and so on that have been done, and use them in planning. Figure out what are the risks that they need to be looking at. How big will certain changes be? How much are the how much will sea levels rise? And plan around the things that are in the report. And also pay more attention to the issues that are flagged in the report. For the Northwest, we went through an interesting process. Instead of just sort of sitting down at the computer and looking up research papers, we convened a group of two different kinds of experts. We had what we called the likelihood experts. These are people who study, and quantify the impacts of climate change. So, for instance, Jeremy Littell, who was at the University of Washington, has done a lot of great work on quantifying wildfires. And then we had the consequences experts. So these were folks mostly from state and federal agencies and nonprofits who were able to say, oh, well, when there's a wildfire, the smoke causes public health problems because of the respiratory challenges. And so we had a long and very fruitful dialogue about both the likelihoods and consequences of different kinds of change, and allowed the issues to kind of rise to the surface that were of greatest concern because they're both very likely and also would have a large consequence.
Well, Philip Mote, take a step back for me here to wrap this up. You're director of Oregon's Climate Change Research Institute. You know how in the past deniers have used a lack of definitive statements in the committee's reports, but in other places as well, to push back on action with climate change. So with this draft of the National Climate Assessment Report, this third draft, how do you envision the deniers' response to climate change? Or is the science developed enough, the review definitive enough, that their window of denial is closed?
Well, we don't give a whole lot of thought to how every audience will receive a report like this, but we want to make sure that all of the statements we make also reflect how confident we are in them and how solid the evidence is to back it up. And at the end of the day, a lot of people, farmers and foresters and investors and infrastructure planners, they hear the chatter about, oh, well, maybe it's not really happening or whatever, and they can see the evidence with their own eyes. They know that there are things going on that they need to deal with now and plan for in the future. And polls show a large majority of Americans have sort of moved beyond the argument, and you know, and a significant and intractable minority will, you know, essentially never be swayed by evidence, no matter how overwhelming. We know that about a lot of other issues, scientific and otherwise. And, you know, we can't convince everybody with a report. All we can do is lay out the evidence as clearly and as responsibly as we can.
And you have, as you mentioned, business people, insurance people on this committee looking at the consequences of climate change. In putting the report together, were there any policy prescriptions that that seemed logical and applicable to you?
The report has two sort of policy-directed chapters, one on adaptation, learning to live with the changes, and one on mitigation, learning to reduce the emissions and other causes of change. And, you know, the reducing the emissions question is huge and complicated and very political. You know, in a lot of ways, we know what the steps are and very roughly how much they'll cost. You know, investing in energy efficiency in new buildings is the greatest return on investment that, you know, pays off over the life of the building and greatly reduces emissions associated with producing energy. Increased vehicle efficiencies are and coming up with ways to design cities and towns that reduce the necessity to drive a lot. Those are ways that also reduce emissions and reduce our need to import foreign oil. There are a lot of other steps that the report outlines, and you know, none of them are terribly surprising. But it's a big challenge to implement those on the sort of scale needed to stabilize the climate.
And I guess I do have one last question. Rapidly, that climate is changing rapidly. This has been growing and clear evidence in this National Climate Assessment Report, the draft that's out. You'll have public comment on it. Has the rapidity of climate change surprised you? Are we seeing even more rapidity and surprise in the rapidity?
There are certainly some measures of climate that have not changed rapidly, but there are some that have changed that at astonishing speeds. So, for instance, the disappearance of the September Arctic sea ice and the June Northern Hemisphere snow cover, these are trends that over the last 20 years have not only surprised people looking at the observations, but have exceeded anything that our climate models have produced in their simulations, and we have some you know, fairly aggressive climate models in how they represent climate change, and these two changes in particular exceed anything that the climate models had foreseen. The you know, successive heat wave and drought in 2011-2012, of course, got a lot of attention here in the U.S. Fortunately, in the Northwest, we enjoyed the benefits of a fairly dry summer without a lot of the costs. It wasn't a severe summer, but yeah, there are a lot of changes that are surprising even the scientists.
I imagine more to come as well. All right, Philip Mote, thanks for taking the time and waking up so early. You're in Austria, is that right?
Australia.
Oh, you're in Australia.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Yeah.
Sorry, Austria, Australia. You can see how I'd get confused. But I appreciate you waking up so early to talk to us.
It's not a problem. I'm kind of a morning person anyway. So.
All right. Thank you. We'll talk again, I hope. Thanks a lot. Philip Mote is the director of Oregon Climate Change Research Institute. He is a professor in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University in Corvallis, a 60-member National Climate Assessment and Development Advisory Committee, NACADAC, has just released a draft of the National Climate Assessment Report. There'll be a public comment period. It'll go before it'll be released after that review period. This is Weekday.
Forty-one degrees in Seattle, partly cloudy, partly sunny. Forecast says expect at least some clouds through the rest of the day, and we're probably not going to make it out of the 30s.
KUOW and the Nordic Heritage Museum present the Nordic Lights Film Festival, highlighting contemporary feature-length and short films from Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden, January 18th through the 20th at SIFF Cinema at the Film Center. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. On the next To The Point, Aaron Swartz, the young computer programmer who helped create Reddit, committed suicide last Friday. How did his passion for sharing information lead to a federal indictment and possible decades in prison? What's the status of Internet freedom? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
That's just about 25 minutes away. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College in Olympia, announcing their annual open house Saturday, January 19th. Preview Day introduces visitors to Evergreen's theme-based classes and student-centered teaching. More information at evergreen.edu/preview day.
Left. Matt Bryan has kicked a 49-yard field goal.
We had the tragedy of Cafe Racer. We've had gun violence in this city too many times.
How long would you like to change religions? I have a free book written by Jesus.
No, no, Elder Cunningham. That's not how we do it. You're making things up again.
We're in the chat room talking about the Book of Mormon, gun control, and sports in Seattle. Prometheus Brown, a.k.a. MC Geo of Blue Scholars, Seattle-based hip-hop artist, is here. Good to see you again.
Yes, town all day. Good to be here.
And Leah Baltus, editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. Good to see you again.
It's good to be here.
All right, you groaned. I heard the audible groan, Geo, when you heard that that cut. What'd you learn from the Seahawks coming so close and then falling short?
Oh, man. That game was a compact version of the season itself.
It was.
Yeah, it was like reliving September through December in 3 hours. And I was with a bunch of my rapper friends who came over to the crib, man. Yeah, at the 30-second mark, we were jumping up and down.
Your mistake and the Seahawks' mistake too, right?
Yeah, I think we celebrated prematurely.
Too much adrenaline.
Yeah, way too much. But a great season, you know. I guess that's one coping mechanism is to fall back on that. And you can't show up. I wrote an article. We went back and forth with Jonathan Zwickel for City Arts. I just wrote an article for them, and we went on a back and forth on the email. And when we were yesterday, and he made me realize that you can't show up for a playoff game and play part of the game and expect to win. So accepting that makes me able to move forward with it.
Now, I have had friends who said, no way am I accepting, well, it was a good season because they showed they're a strong team. That no way. Second is not acceptable in sports, and they have to have a harder attitude. Can't have a sort of a Northwest laid-back attitude if they want to succeed.
I agree for them, for the players. Yeah. They should definitely feel that this ain't enough. But for my own mental health, I need to feel like I need closure for this season in order to move forward.
You made a joke about being an arts editor talking about sports. Did you follow the Seahawks at all this season?
I surely did. I am a rabid football fan.
Yeah. Ah, well, there you go. So an arts editor that's a rabid football fan.
Well, one has to have balance in one's life, you know.
Did you get a lesson from the comeback, the loss? Do you agree with Gio about players need to step up, but we need sort of coping mechanisms?
I do. I also think that one of the major features of sports is youth. And so it's encouraging that the team is as young as it is, and you can't help but comfort yourself by thinking that there is a lot of promise yet ahead.
Russell Wilson, kind of impressive guy, huh?
Very impressive guy and inspiring. You know, as a transplant here, I've been here for about 12 years, and it's taken me a long time to warm up to the Seahawks. It's a club that's hard to find your way to the heart of, and Russell Wilson has totally got me there.
You too?
Oh, yeah, man, Russell Wilson. I mean, from the jump, I was one of the dudes that was curiously optimistic at a time when I think half the people were like, no, Matt Flynn is the dude. And he's shown it with all that expectation on him. And he's been to more colleges than I've performed at, so I can relate to them.
All right, what about the Kings to Seattle rumors? I'm curious about somebody who's been here a long time. You remember the Sonics. You remember the other. I remember the whole thing with the Pilots. I remember reading about it. Any empathy for Kings, Sacramento fans? And the
oh,
Kings?
Yes. Yes, very much so. I mean, I know people in Sacramento personally, and we've had conversations about this, not just this past week, but in the year or so leading up to this when Seattle popped up on the radar as being a possible destination. So, yeah, I feel 100% for them. My excitement is definitely muted by knowing what it's like. So everything that they're saying, everything they're feeling, I know what that's like. On the other hand, it's not completely the same thing. There's definitely parts of it that are similar. You know, at the bottom line is you're taking a team from another city. But I feel like we went through a really more manipulative process that with the whole Clay Bennett saying that he's keeping the team here and the city kind of like bumbling its way towards trying to reconcile the arena thing. I feel on the other hand, there is something a little bit more transparent about what's going on. I mean, these guys are rich dudes don't usually make negotiations with the whole public waiting for the outcome. It's usually behind closed doors and we don't hear about it until it's done. And so there's even more transparency here with that regarding
yeah.
this situation.
Well, that's true. And the Maloofs are an interesting group anyway.
Mercurial.
Yes. Do you... You were here long enough to remember when the Sonics left.
Fair enough.
In the end, though, is it going to be hard to root for a team that we took from another city just as it was taken from us? Or, first game in Sonics uniform, first basket goes in, all that's forgotten?
I think that given how much pain the city endured when we lost our team and how much longing there's been ever since, that when we finally do get a team back, whatever kind of guilt or remorse we might feel toward the poor people of Sacramento, that we will probably get over that.
All right. Leah Baltus is editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine, and Gio is Seattle-based hip-hop artist and Blues Scholars MC. When you were here before, we talked about violence. We talked about the essay you'd written in the Seattle Times. Now we have this gun buyback program. We've had a march. Change? Do you see it bringing change to the city and bringing change to sort of the fear and the concern people had in neighborhoods about what was happening to the young people?
Incremental change.
Incremental.
I mean, it's still fresh in our minds. 2012 was a horrible year of gun violence locally and nationally, too. And it's just seeing things happen, seeing the conversations continue, I think is some progress. I think it remains to be seen what actual change will occur. But none of that will even happen if the conversation isn't happening. So I'm just glad that it always should have been something that when last time I was here, I was an advocate for that, saying that this is, you know, a lot of people are saying this, you know, the time is now. The time's been then and now. And so, you know, moving forward, I hope the conversation continues. And I hope people who firmly believe that we do need some sort of change continue to stand on that, because the people who say we don't need change have been so firm on their stance that I don't think there's any room for us who believe that we need change can waver on that no more. None of this compromise stuff that we've been allowing those who have allowed things to stay the same with the same problems continuing. So more guns in school? Come on, man. We should be, all of us, talking about how ridiculous that is.
The president is going to use the bully pulpit in part, as we talked about earlier in the show, because Congress and the legislature in the state, right? They are pushed by the NRA and their advocates. Is the conversation... Do you get a sense do you have any sense that the conversation is pushing towards change, a sea change?
I think so. I think what Gio
and I know I'm talking to all of us who are living in Seattle, and we're not
in the bubble.
In the bubble, but
a little bit of a bubble, but not without care for the rest of outside the bubble. And I think what Gio said about incremental is kind of the key to the whole thing, because there's an attitude coming from one end of this argument that, you know, there's either a change that perfectly solves all of this or there's no change. And I think it makes sense to try all kinds of smaller things or medium-sized things, and at least to keep the appetite moving forward, to be able to do things. And if that's, you know, Obama an executive order and that sort of thing, and him using that power to whatever extent that he can to chip away at this and at least try some things and see what we can do, at least to maybe change the attitudes people have, then that is a considerable dent, at least, in the problem, as opposed to kind of wringing our hands and waiting to find that one singular solution, which probably doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I'm curious about something. My wife works at the Paramount. She does dressing, costume changes in the back of the house. Book of Mormon tickets? No way. Just no way. Now, you actually saw Book of Mormon.
I did see it. That is one benefit of being an arts editor. But you think you get a ticket too. It was great. I didn't really know what to expect, and I did a good job of not absorbing too much information in advance. But I'm a pretty big South Park fan, and I like the musical Avenue Q, and the guy who wrote that is part of the project or the show. And I thought that the musical was better than the South Park movie. I thought it was really something about putting real humans, and you wouldn't believe it, but the choreography actually is a huge piece, because the choreography is really funny, and dancing people are always going to have more nuance than dancing animated characters. So that was really powerful, and the writing is just super, super smart, and it's nice to see a musical that feels so relevant and honest and sincere in a way that makes sense in our world and doesn't feel shticky and kind of like just pretend that this is normal.
And does not mock Mormonism. I mean,
no.
It satirizes it, but also
There's also a warmth there in some kind of way. Yeah.
It's
not harsh.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you a South Park fan, Gio?
Yeah. I haven't kept up with it recently, but yeah, big.
Too often those guys hear that too, by the way. Oh yeah, I love South Park, the earlier, funnier years.
Right. And I still keep up with it every once in a while.
Do you want to see this show?
I do. And is it still going?
It is. Oh, yeah. The 20th, I think.
Yeah. But I heard the tickets are hard to come by. And when I was traveling on tour throughout 2012, it seemed like we were in every city that it was just playing in. You know, so, yeah, I'd love to see it. If someone out there want to hook me up some tickets in exchange for some CDs and T-shirts and backstage passes or something, hit me up.
I think they still have Rush tickets, right? I think they still have Rush.
Yeah, they're doing one of those lottery kind of things with the Rush tickets, and they're cheaper that way, too.
So you're writing an essay for City Arts. What's it about?
Yes, I just submitted it yesterday. It's about the intersection of rap and photography. And where I stand with the whole thing.
What's at the intersection? Are we learning something about rap through the photography, or is the photography changing because of the influence of rap?
I think both. I mean, I talk about how we're definitely at a saturation period with the digital technology, phones, DSLRs, and then the audience for it with social media and the internet. And the amount of rappers there are out there and the amount of photographers out there. You go to a rap show now, you'll see 5 rappers on stage and 10 photographers on there with them. And coming from a guy who's making music now, seeing this all happen and remembering when you used to have to wait till Friday to see the pictures you took on Monday, and you had to pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars to even record a song in a studio. You couldn't just do it at home and put it on the internet and get it listened to around the world. How crazy this is to me. Having seen both ends of the spectrum.
Positive, democratizing in the way they say it is?
Yes, always. Just with anything that becomes democratized to a bunch of people who have yearned for it but just recently got it, it's always going to be both a positive and a potentially negative thing.
Because you're assailed by all the media.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, conversations about quality versus quantity and all that stuff, too.
All right, we'll read that next month.
February.
That's Gio of Blue Scholars, Leah Baltus, editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. I thank you both for coming inside the chat room with us.
Thanks.
Yes, thank you.
We're kicking that name around. We'll see if I like it. Here's a little music. Talk to you tomorrow.
Hello.
My name is Jack.
Music from the Book of Mormon on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 10:59. France will end its intervention in Mali only once stability has returned to that West African country. That's what the president of France said today. More on that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College in Olympia, announcing their annual open house Saturday, January 19th. Preview Day introduces visitors to Evergreen's theme-based classes and student-centered teaching. More information at evergreen.edu/preview day.
Job growth continues to be sluggish, but there's one big exception, temporary work. If you're temping, freelancing, or doing contract work, we'd like to hear from you. How's it working out for you? We're going in-depth on this today at 12:20, and we want you to share your thoughts right now. Give us a call, 20. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.